It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Rob Ferret. This summer marked the 50th anniversary of the country's Civil Rights Act. It outlawed discrimination in the U.S. based on race, color, religion, sex, and national origin. The 1964 Act is considered landmark legislation, but it wasn't actually the first law of its kind.
Wisconsin Civil Rights Act was passed in 1895, 7 decades before the country's. Here to tell us about how that law came into existence is Claiborne Benson, founder and executive director of Wisconsin's Black Historical Museum. Claiborne, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me today. So I got a little cold, but other than that, I'm here.
Excellent. Well, we're glad to have you.
Thank you.
How did Wisconsin's Civil Rights Act apply? What did it encompass back in 1895?
I'd like to say to you that Wisconsin has been at the forefront of civil rights activities since its very beginning of the state's history. I mean, simple things like slavery did exist in the state of Wisconsin, but when the state became a state in 1840, they applied for statehood in 1846. They eventually became a state in 1848. They denied African Americans having the right to vote in that. But when I say denied, the citizens of the state took it to the streets in the 1850s, much like the collective bargaining issue in Madison. So was Milwaukee, Wisconsin in the 1850s in terms of demanding the right to vote. And in the Governor William Randall's election of 1857, they made it a referendum item, and indeed African Americans gained the right to vote. It was hung up in the courts for a minute, but eventually the courts clearly said that we always had a right to vote. And I only mention these things, and there are even more, because Wisconsin has always been dealing with issues and fighting for rights legally. Now, we're talking about the civil rights bill that occurred in 1895. The judge cites the 13th and the 14th Amendment. And so he's not just dealing with Wisconsin. He is saying that we live in this one country, and there was a war fought for us to have these rights. And he read the 13th and the 14th Amendment to say that Mr. Howell should have the right to set.
Well, let's back up a little bit. I want to get the start of this whole story, because it's fascinating. Now,
it is.
You're talking about Owen Howell, and
yes,
this was the kernel that planted Wisconsin's civil rights law, you know, back in 1895. What happened to Owen?
I don't know what happened to him after the
but that initial story at the theater.
In 1898 and 1890, they filed a lawsuit, and it's William Green that actually takes the case to making it a law. But it's Howell who demands justice for discrimination in the courts. He is sold a ticket to come into the theater, and the usher then addresses him to a balcony seat where he feels uncomfortable. He says he doesn't want to sit there, and the matter ends up in court. And as I said to you, the judge refers to the 13th and the 14th Amendment in terms of that indeed he is right, that he should not have to be seated other than any other citizen in the in the theater. And so he won the case. And then later, William T. Green, who is a local attorney who works with him on that case, goes on to get the measure passed as a state legislature and a law. And the law still does exist today.
Now, that's an interesting story, because this is back in 1895, 50 years or 70 years before the
Well,
the
can
civil
I tell you why it's interesting? There are two things that the citizens really wanted, and they never got the second thing. But the first thing was to get this discrimination bill passed. The second real important thing that they wanted to get is to be able to date and see whoever it is, or marry whoever it is that they choose to marry. And that included, because there was a law against it, that included white women. that African Americans wanted to have the privilege to marry a white man if they chose to do so, or and likewise if the woman chose to do so. Those are the two major things, and the issue of the marriage came after the turn of the century. And then one other thing I wanted to share with you is that this comes on the heel of the passage of Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896. Plessy is testing the law in Louisiana, and it becomes a national issue. But the South and the citizens want a return to the way things used to be. And that's the very reason why Lincoln passed the 13th Amendment to end slavery and to demand rights. And yet this country passed Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896, just after our Civil Rights Bill of 1895.
Now, going back to the civil rights law, once it was passed, it was, you know, it was way ahead of its time. Was it actually observed? Was it enforced?
Oh, yes, it was. And in fact, in my lifetime, I've seen a number of people prosecuted under the same law. Oh, very much so. A small fine, I think what was the fine, $25 or $50? $50 is, and there was some incarceration as well, but it was observed, and no question about it. It took the citizens to thresh ahead and to demand that the state be accountable, and they were. But yes, it was observed. Again, the law is still on the books today.
And did it, do you think, change any of the racist attitudes of the day?
I don't think so. No, I don't. I think that Wisconsin's been always progressive. And then there is those, I mean, clearly the state of Wisconsin passed the personal liberty law late 1840s. I mean, that's way ahead of its time. And if you saw the movie 12 Years a Slave, where the Solomon North is jacked off the street and put back into slavery, Wisconsin was fighting for that to make sure that that law is on the books. And it passed. And it's Wisconsin who produces military soldiers and an African-American regiment and the only African-American officer to fight in the Civil War, the only one. Wisconsin does all kinds of interesting things. But again, when I talk about these accomplishments, I can talk equally about negative things. They're not confused. They go out of their way. They're the only state in the Union to defy the Fugitive Slave Law. That's a constitutional law, and that law is serious. And Wisconsin goes on record to say this is not a law in which we're going to obey. But that doesn't mean that they want it to be our brothers or our sisters or our next-door neighbors. There is a fine line there. The accomplishments, yes, but on the other end, the KKK arrives. There's lynchings in Milwaukee, Wisconsin in 1861 between ethnic groups back and forth. There are all kinds of things that have happened in the state that makes it unique and special.
Well, Claiborne, we'll leave it there. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, well, that was too short, but thank
you. It goes by fast. We've been speaking with Claiborne Benson, founder and executive director of Wisconsin's Black Historical Museum. The country's Civil Rights Act turned 50 this summer, but Wisconsin's law barring discrimination in public accommodations based on race came first by 70 years.
With many questions still surrounding the death of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, there's been an increased call for police departments around the nation to adopt officer body cameras.
While some have expressed concerns over civil rights, supporters of the cameras say they're good for police transparency, and one Milwaukee politician says he'd like to bring the idea to the city of Milwaukee.
Joining us now is Tony Zielinski. He's a Milwaukee alderman who represents the city's 14th district. Tony, welcome to Central Time.
Great. Thank you very much.
So you're calling on Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett to include funding for body cameras in his next proposed budget for 2015. Why do you think it's necessary?
Well, actually, I think it's necessary for a number of reasons. First, I think that it's going to make citizens in the community feel more comfortable when they deal with the police department. And at the same time, I think it provides an extra layer of protection for police officers that follow proper procedures and rules, because there have been instances in the past where there have been, you know, unsubstantiated allegations against specific police officers, and this would provide the kind of evidence that we need for the police officers that follow the rules. And lastly, I feel that this is actually a cost-saving measure, even though there'll be a significant capital cost up front. I believe it in the end, it will save taxpayer money. And the reason for that is that, you know, there are lawsuits that take place over, you know, citizen police department interactions. And I feel with the cameras, a lot of those lawsuits would just go on the wayside because there's clear evidence one way or the other.
What's the estimated cost?
I believe the estimated cost is somewhere in the neighborhood of $750,000, and that's at approximately $400 per police officer, assuming we do all the police officers.
Okay.
But that's not, you know, that's not etched in stone. I think that we might be able to get a better deal. We may start off with a pilot program. There's all sorts of different scenarios that we may ultimately decide to pursue. But the bottom line is, I believe that this is the wave of the future, and I believe that gradually more and more police departments will embrace this new device.
Well, there have been petitions circulating around Milwaukee recently calling for these cameras. Have you had people in your district contacting you about this issue?
Yes. Everybody that I've had contact with on this issue has been overwhelmingly in support, except for one individual. And again, I am not ever going to, you know, get 100% of support for anything. There's always going to be, you know, some issues and concerns. But I think that if we go about this in the right way and solicit input from residents in the area as far as their ideas, suggestions, concerns, I think that we can fashion or mold a package that could address everybody's concern and have a better system in place.
How do you convince the city leadership, though, that it's worth the cost, especially given, I'm sure, a lot of other competing priorities at this time?
Well, I think that, I would say quite confidently that I feel strongly that we will be successful in introducing this budget amendment if the mayor doesn't do so himself. I know that a number of the African-American aldermen have had concerns in the past about, you know, police relations in the community, and I think that the African-American members on the council will be strongly supportive because that would provide an extra layer of protection for many of their residents.
This topic has come up before. It's been part of the national dialogue, I think, for a while, especially courtesy of groups like the ACLU. Anytime you talk about personal cameras, you have concerns over things like infringement on civil rights and privacy. How do you make sure that those are addressed?
Well, I think, you know, the planning and the input that we solicit that goes into it would address those concerns. My experience has been that, you know, if you provide an opportunity for dialogue and input, that you can come up and craft a plan that would address everybody's concerns. Again, you're never going to address 100% of everybody's concerns, but I think all in all, this will make the police department a lot stronger department, and I believe it will provide better service in the long run.
Are you aware of any previous incidents in Milwaukee where cameras could have resolved an issue, or could someone look at this and say this is the solution in search of a problem?
Well, I know not too long ago, maybe it was as recent as two and a half months ago, we had an individual that was shot at Red Arrow Park by a police officer, and the statement was made that this individual was attacking the police officer, and there was a lot of questions about, you know, whether, you know what actually happened. And I think that that's a good example of where these cameras would have been real handy in terms of getting at the bottom of what happened.
This is something that a local Madison alder person is also proposing to the city council here, at least starting out with a local committee in Madison. And in response, Jim Palmer of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association had said that while that's a fine idea, the technology may not be useful yet. And he cited a couple of things like, you know, if an officer is to wear a camera on their glasses, that impedes their ability to see. And also shoulder cameras, it sounds like, are the other option. And that by wearing a camera on the shoulder, it doesn't offer the proper perspective to actually videotape the footage that you want to get. In other words, filming at the right angle and so on. Is the technology there to address the concerns that you have?
Yeah. I mean, there's still details that have to be worked out, but I believe that the technology is sufficient that one of the methods that we ultimately choose will be the appropriate method to accomplish and achieve our goals. As with any initiative, there's always going to be some rough edges that have to be smoothed out. And so we have to ensure that we exercise our due diligence to make sure that the final package we ultimately advance is the one that is the most efficient and effective.
Help us understand from both sides how these cameras might impact behavior, not just officer behavior, but quite possibly suspect behavior, citizen behavior. Talk about the impact that way.
Oh, I think it's going to be a positive impact all across the board. I think that if anybody is aware that this is being videotaped and this is being recorded, I think that people are going to be a lot more careful in the choice of words and their actions, because there's going to be a documented record of that. And so I think that that's actually another, you know, specific example of how this is going to improve the work of the police department.
A few departments in the state already use body cameras. Are you familiar with which ones those are? And do we have any data on how cameras have worked out in those communities?
I don't have any specific data at this point. I'm in the process of still gathering more information. Based on what I have accumulated so far, I feel very strongly that this is something that we need to move forward with, and I believe that it will make the department stronger. As you're probably well aware, we're at the embryonic stages of this. We mm-hmm. still got a few more months before we vote on the budget. We haven't even started the budget deliberations yet. So, you know, we're at the embryonic stages right now, and there's a lot of, you know, questions that need to be answered. But I feel quite confident based on the information I have so far that we're ready to move forward in some fashion this year.
Now, on the other hand, is it possible, though, that with the presence of cameras, it might actually negatively impact the way in which an officer approaches his or her decisions? Would it impede fast action, for example, in an emergent situation?
You know, I really don't think so. I mean, these officers are professionals. They're highly trained professionals. They're trained to make split-second decisions. And I think if anything, if I was a police officer, I would have the added comfort of knowing that this provides an extra layer of security for me if there's an unfounded allegation thrown my way.
Have you talked or heard from any police officers about this idea?
I have not had any direct conversations. I've had played phone tag with a few people, but so the answer would be no.
Okay. Well, I'm curious too if the chief of police has weighed in on it.
Yeah, I mean, my understanding, based on the comments that I read on as far as Police Chief Flynn is concerned, is that, you know, they're very interested in looking into this as something to augment their existing accessories.
And meanwhile, coming back to Madison, where the new police chief, Mike Koval, was asked about this as well, and his response was, if I have money and I have the choice to put it toward cameras or funding a few more neighborhood police officer positions, I'm going to go with neighborhood officers. What's your response to that? Should it be an either or, a both and? What do you think the higher priority should be, technology or more officers?
Well, you know, it's a balancing test. You know, more officers is an operating expense. The cameras are a capital expense. But I feel right now that if we had to choose, if it was, you know, one or the other, I would go with technology at this point right now.
We're talking with Milwaukee Alderman Tony Zielinski. He's calling on Mayor Tom Barrett to include funding for police body cameras in his upcoming budget. And we'd like to hear from you, too. Are you a Milwaukee resident? Do you think that your police department should be equipped with these cameras? How would you feel if they were? Do you support the practice of officers wearing cameras in general? Do you have concerns over civil liberties? We want to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll get to your calls after the news, and we'll look forward to more conversations with Tony Zielinski of the City of Milwaukee Common Council. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
And don't forget, you can post on the Central Time Facebook page your thoughts and comments. We always like to hear what you have to say. We read every comment. Post on the Central Time Facebook page, 800-642-1234. What do you think about body cams on police officers? Body cameras, would it aid in police transparency? Would it help address problems that we may be seeing in police forces around the country? 800-642-1234.
We're talking with Milwaukee Alderman Tony Zielinski. He's calling for funding to equip the Milwaukee Police Department with body cameras for its officers. What do you think of that idea? You can let us know at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Tony, let's start by taking a call from Mark in Green Bay. Hi, Mark.
Hi.
What do you think of this proposal?
Well, I like the idea myself. I think anything that can hold everybody more accountable, the better. My question is, are these cameras he's proposing openly at the discretion of the officer to turn on and off at will? Or is it something that is on all the time, whether they like it or not, or whether like it or not?
Well, right now, as I mentioned earlier, we're at the embryonic stages, and the kind of questions that you're raising and that we're discussing right now are the types of discussions or issues that we're going to include in our discussions about how these would be operated. So right now, we still got a few months to go through the budget deliberation to make any final determination about that. So. But, this type of input and feedback is very helpful because these are important questions and policy, issues that need to be, factored into the equation.
And do you have any early indication of whether your idea will come to fruition in one way or another in the next budget?
I feel very, very confident that this would get approved in the next budget. Either the mayor will include it in the budget or we'll have sufficient support to get this approved. As I alluded to earlier, I believe that this will save the taxpayers money instead of costing them money. You look at the situation in the Ferguson situation right now. You know how much money that's going to cost? If there was a camera there that would, bring some closure to that issue, we would, save taxpayers all sorts of money, and I believe that the same principle would apply here. And so, to go back to your earlier question, if I want technology or police officers, if it's technology like this where ultimately we could save money and use that to possibly get more officers, I think this is the better way to go.
Well, on the other hand, with camera footage where we can actually see, for example, a young Michael Brown being shot, that could also incite just as much unrest as what we're seeing in Ferguson now. So is it a guarantee that we're going to save money, or will the pendulum swing in a different direction?
Well, I think that, there's a difference between unrest and legal costs associated. If there's an open and cut case one way or the other, there's not going to be as strong of a chance of a long drawn out legal battle, which is going to result in saving taxpayer dollars.
We're talking with Milwaukee Alderman Tony Zielinski, and we're taking your calls and your thoughts on whether or not to equip officers with body cameras. You can let us know what you think or what questions you have at 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Jim in Manitowoc called in and wanted to know why we aren't talking about putting cameras in guns to record the most potentially lethal part of any police interaction. Apparently, that technology is already available. Tony, are you familiar with that?
I'll tell you, I wasn't, but now I am. I'd be happy to look at that. That's a very interesting thought. I don't have a position. I want to make it very clear one way or the other on that, but that's certainly an interesting thought.
And going forward, as you apply this new technology and introduce it into the city, what kind of culture shift might need to happen in terms of officer acceptance, for example?
Well, again, where I would be coming from is that this protects them. All they have to do is follow the proper procedures and rules, and they're protected. They don't have to worry about unfunded allegations. And I'm sure there's going to be some resistance. There's always resistance anytime there's change, and that's what history has shown us time and time again. And that will be the case with this as well. But ultimately, I think that technology has been a friend to taxpayers, to whatever cause that exists out there, and this will be another example of using technology for the betterment of our community.
And some of that technology is already being used in the way of squad cameras. What kinds of benefits or costs have those brought to the city of Milwaukee so far?
I haven't quantified anything with the squad, cameras. As I said, this we're at the embryonic stages right now. As we go through the budget deliberation process, these types of answers will come forward, and we'll have something a little bit more crystal. Right now, we're at the stage where we're bringing forth the idea. We're soliciting input, suggestion, and ideas so that we can include that in our deliberations to make sure that we move forward with the best possible plan.
All right, let's talk to Mark in Wisconsin Dells. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you doing? I just want to make a quick comment because I'm driving first. I would definitely support any issue or any technology that could be used to streamline the fact-finding mission of any investigation. I think that would be a great thing, and I do agree that I believe it will save money in the long run. I'd also like to bring up a related issue from my own experience. Having attended some workshops at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center in Glencoe, Georgia years ago, it was absolutely proven that police officers should not carry handguns because they're inherently dangerous. Specific data was 9 out of 10 police officers are shot on the job with their own guns when they're shot on the job, and 9 out of 10 police officers miss their target in the heat of passion when they have to use a gun. And so innocent people are in jeopardy. And I think it's a subject that should be talked about but is not talked about, because I think it would save a lot of money and a lot of grief, and a lot of the people who have died in recent months around the country would probably still be alive if it were not police officers did not carry handguns on their hip.
Thanks, Mark. Tony, do you have a response to that?
Well, I wasn't prepared for a question on that. Presently, I'm of the opinion that police officers need guns. But I am always willing and interested in looking at all data and all information, and anything subject to change in the face of new evidence and new information for the better. But right now, I'm for police officers having guns.
Let's talk to Mark in Madison. Mark, what's your question or comment?
My comment is that this is just a wonderful idea, and it will save the municipality a lot of money. My experience as a trial lawyer is that, from when they initially started using dashboard cams for drunk driving, that when I got the dashboard cam feed out or print out and showed it to the clients realized how bad of a case they had, and they didn't want to go to trial. And that's going to keep a lot of traffic cases and disorderly conducts from going into municipal court and charging the city for overtime for the police to testify. I think it's a great thing, and it'll protect the officers.
Thanks, Mark. Tony, is that what you anticipate happening as well?
Oh, yeah. I think that this will save money, not only in terms of, attorney fees and long, drawn-out legal battles, but I think, there's ancillary costs and, and tertiary costs that would be saved as well. I think, and I have to add another point to this discussion as well. It's very rare when I've come across an issue like this where there's such overwhelming support for a proposal. As I mentioned earlier, I only had one constituent that has expressed any kind of concern about this, and everybody else, right across the board, has been strongly in support of this. So, I doubt very seriously that we're not going to be able to move forward with this through the budget process.
And Tony, in our last minute here, in the interim, I guess, before any technology technology like that starts to take shape on the Milwaukee police force. What about the prevalence of people with cell phone cameras, Google Glass, those types of technologies that are, as we see in social media and on the internet today, are already capturing police activities?
Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, those are obviously out there, but I think that with the addition of police body cameras, that will take that to a totally new level in a very positive way.
Well, Tony, thank you so much for being with us today.
Okay, thank you for having me. I appreciate the discussion and the dialogue.
Sure. Tony, Alderman Tony Zielinski represents Milwaukee's 14th District for the Milwaukee City Council.
One of WPR's most prolific readers is with us again to recommend some new books worth a read. Steve Paulson joins us now. He's the executive producer of WPR's To the Best of Our Knowledge. Steve, welcome back.
It's great to be here.
Well, so you've got three more books lately that have made your must-read list. Tell us about the first one. This is by author Haruki Murakami. Why is a new book by him considered such a big deal?
He's developed this following just around the world, but especially in Japan, in his native country. The first week that this new novel, Colorless Tsukuru Tazaki, was published, a million copies were sold in Japan. And every time when it sort of comes around to talk of the next Nobel Prize in Literature, his name surfaces. Supposedly, he's one of the favorites. So he's a big deal, and it's an event when a new Murakami novel appears.
And his novels are often quite long. How big is this one?
This is actually of moderate size, and I have to say it's compulsively readable. He's one of my favorite writers. I've read almost everything he's written, and this one sucked me in right away.
What's it about?
It's about it. You know, actually, can I read you the very beginning of it, which is kind of a good setup to it? This is how it begins. From July of his sophomore year in college until the following January, all Tsukuru Tazaki could think about was dying. He turned 20 during this time, but the special watershed, becoming an adult, meant nothing. Taking his own life seemed the most natural solution, and even now he couldn't say why he hadn't taken this final step. Crossing that threshold between life and death would have been easier than swallowing down a slick raw egg.
Wow.
So it kind of sucks you in. It's the story of this guy, Tsukuru, who is in his mid-30s, and he's reflecting back on this very traumatic thing that happened to him earlier in his life. When he was a teenager, he was one of a very close group of friends, five in all, and they were inseparable. They did everything together. And then he goes off to college, and then he comes back, and suddenly he finds out that he's been cut off, and none of his friends will talk to him. He doesn't know why. They won't tell him. They won't speak to him. And he just sort of lives with this, and he's profoundly depressed for a long time and sort of starts to pull his life back together. And this novel is really the story of figuring out what happened. You know, why did all of his closest friends cut him off?
Well, it sounds like a page-turner for sure. And as far as the style, if people are considering taking this on, what is the style like?
Well, there's kind of a paradox at the heart of every Murakami novel. He's actually not a great prose stylist. I mean, it's in translation, but it would seem that the choice of words are, you know, there's nothing especially stylistic about it. The plot twists are sometimes kind of obvious, but there's something mesmerizing about every Murakami novel. There's a surreal quality to it. His characters all kind of inhabit their dreams. Sometimes they communicate in their dreams, and they sort of work out this sort of psychic landscape. And so it just sucks you in, and I think once you start reading a Murakami novel, it's almost impossible to put it down.
That's interesting. So you're saying this guy who's being, you know, slated maybe to get a Pulitzer Prize is not the best.
A Nobel Prize.
Nobel Prize is not the best prose craftsperson, but
yeah, and I think
you
everyone
can't stop reading it.
I think everyone acknowledges that, but he has a sensibility. I mean, there's a distinctive quality to a Murakami novel that you just, it's just apparent. You know that you're in his universe and no one else could have written this book.
All right. That sounds like a good one. And you've got another. Now we're going to move into the realm of nonfiction. And this one is about, is this a book which is a surprise that it even exists. It's about the famously reclusive Harper Lee. She's sort of the female J.D. Salinger.
Sort of. Now, Harper Lee, of course, wrote To Kill a Mockingbird, which and she wrote this in the early 1960s. It was a huge bestseller. Won a Pulitzer Prize, was made into an acclaimed movie starring Gregory Peck. And it was everywhere. And, of course, it's on virtually every high school reading list. So tens of millions of copies are in print. But she stopped doing interviews, or at least official interviews, in 1964. She's famously private. She's a bit different than a recluse like J.D. Salinger or Thomas Pynchon. She's not hiding, but she just doesn't want to talk to the press. And then finally, this woman, Maria Mills, who happened to have grown up in Madison, actually, she broke through.
And how did she do that?
Well, she had been a reporter at the Chicago Tribune and was sent down to do a story about Harper Lee. And she didn't expect to be able to meet her, but she made contact with Nell Harper. Nell Harper is how she's referred to with her sister, Alice. And Alice has been kind of Harper Lee's gatekeeper over the years. And she apparently charmed Alice. And then Maria Mills got a call at her motel from Harper Lee saying, could we meet? And one thing led to another, and they became friends. And then Maria Mills suffered from lupus, and she ended up moving down to this little town, Monroeville, Alabama, and rented the house right next door to the two sisters, Harper Lee and her sister Alice, and got to know them quite well, sort of hung out with them.
Wow. So was the idea that she wanted time to recuperate and also maybe work on the book of a lifetime?
I think that's right. And she talked a lot with Harper Lee, would go to McDonald's, would go to Burger King, to hang out with her, you know, sort of for this world famous
wow.
author, you know, she lived this very simple life, but a complex woman. And these were not official interviews. And so Harper Lee never said, you know, this is an authorized biography, but she apparently signed off on it. But there has been actually quite a lot of controversy about this book since it came out.
Really? So what's the controversy?
Well, right before this book by Maria Mills, The Mockingbird Next Door, came out, the day before, in fact, there was a statement issued in the name of Harper Lee, which said, I have not approved any book about me. It said, rest assured, as long as I'm alive, any book purporting to be with my cooperation is a falsehood. So there's been a lot of controversy about this, but it's not actually clear that Harper Lee herself wrote that statement.
Why not?
Possibly some of her handlers did. She'd had a serious stroke a few years ago. Her health has declined a lot. And actually, her sister Alice had come out a couple of years ago vouching for Maria Mills. And so I think it's fair to say that Harper Lee remains a mystery.
Wow. Well, so you've read this book. Can you give us any tidbits about what Harper Lee was like?
Yeah, well, it's she seemed to have kind of a, sort of a love-hate relationship with the celebrity that she had. She actually split her time between New York and Alabama for years, and she was clearly proud of the book that she wrote. And one of the mysteries, actually, is she never wrote a second novel. And so that's been one of these enduring questions of, you know, why did not Harper Lee ever write another novel? And Maria Mills asked her sister Alice and said, well, you know, how can you ever compete with that? How could you ever measure up to that kind of success again? And so, you know, complicated, private, a little cantankerous, obviously very smart and kind of fierce.
Mm, wow. Well, that's an interesting story for sure. And you've got another nonfiction selection. This one you're really nuts about. This one is called In the Shadow of the Sabretooth. I love the title already. What's this one about?
Well, this is by Doug Peacock. And it's the – Doug Peacock is a well-known wilderness advocate, is a Vietnam vet, a former great friend of Edward Abbey, and he's an amateur archaeologist. And this is the story of – the last era of global warming, which was sometime during the Pleistocene era, so, you know, 15,000 years ago or something like that. And there really are two great mysteries if you go back to ancient history in North America. One is, when did the first humans arrive here? There's been a lot of controversy about that. Some people think it's maybe 12,000 years ago. Some people think it was tens of thousands of years ago, maybe 40,000 years. And the other great question is, why did the great mammals that used to roam North America, the mammoth, the saber-toothed tiger, the giant short-faced bear, which was twice as big as the grizzly bear, why did they all disappear roughly around the same time as the Clovis hunters 11 to 12,000 years ago? And Peacock basically concludes, I mean, it's very speculative, but it's probably a combination of they were hunted into extinction and it was the era of global warming and their old habitat disappeared.
Well, this is an interesting piece on a unique time in history. So why was Peacock, the author, drawn to this particular time?
Well, he has a fascinating backstory. He was a Green Beret medic in the Vietnam War back in the 1960s, suffered from a lot of post-traumatic stress when he came back to this country. Ended up, he couldn't be around people. He would go out into these wilderness areas, and he had this one kind of primal encounter with a mother grizzly bear and her cubs, and thought he might die, didn't. And sort of it changed his life. And he spent the next few decades protecting grizzly bears. And so he's obsessed with this question of what is it like to live in an area where the humans are not the top predator, where you are in a place where other animals could kill you. And he says it totally changes the psychic landscape. And so he's writing about this period 15,000 years ago, when there were all these great beasts, and certainly humans were not the top guy around. And so he's sort of wondering, what was that like? So I think he has sort of this great affinity to what life must have been like when these early humans were around, sort of trying to survive in the most difficult circumstances.
So what does he want us to take away about super predators and about grizzlies in particular?
Well, I think he wants us to marvel at wilderness and what it's like to not just be around other people. And the grizzly for him is it's a symbol that as long as the grizzly is with us and healthy, and grizzly habitat is endangered, and there aren't that many grizzlies anymore, especially in the lower 48 states. As long as there's a healthy population of grizzly bears, then he thinks, okay, humans will be okay. But if grizzlies disappear, then something will be lost about what it means to be human.
Steve, thank you so much. Those are like three great picks, and we're going to put them up on the Central Time Facebook page.
It's always a pleasure.
Steve Paulson is the executive producer on To the Best of Our Knowledge here at Wisconsin Public Radio.
And if there's something you want to hear for our Share Something segment or Curious Wisconsin, why don't you give us a call at our hotline, 855-683-5422. That's 855-683-5422. We always love to hear from you and to get your show suggestions.
Maybe there's something unique about the town that you live in. Maybe there's a feature of the landscape you've always been curious about, a story you heard that you want to find out whether it's true or not. That's what Curious Wisconsin is for. Among other things, call us at 855-683-5422 and leave your suggestions there. We're always happy to hear from you.